Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki's Collegium for Advanced Studies. In today's episode, we are returning to the new T.N.T. Clark Handbook of Analytic Theology. I am once again joined by Jonathan Thompson to discuss my chapter in the handbook called Classical Theism. In today's episode, we discuss the ever-valid modal collapse argument against divine simplicity. Conversations over this argument have gotten heated online, and many confusions abound. So Jonathan and I clarify what the argument actually says, and then consider different objections to the argument. You've been asking for the return of objection time, and today we deliver. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear in the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Ready or not, here's Jonathan and I talking about God. Enjoy.
So, Ryan, when I think about William Lane Craig, I think about the Kalam cosmological argument. When I think about Alvin Plantinga, I think about Reformed epistemology. When I think about Ryan Mullins, I think about obscure death metal, but I also think about divine simplicity and modal collapse. And one of your arguments that has received the most attention online is your modal collapse argument against divine simplicity. Now, in the T.N.T. Clark Handbook of Analytic Theology, you clarify this argument in your chapter called Classical Theism. So let's set the stage for this moment. Start by reminding everyone what the doctrine of divine simplicity is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like we talked about in the previous episode, divine simplicity is this really strong claim. And I think a lot of people just kind of miss how strong it is. So the claim, again, is that whatever is intrinsic to God is identical to God. And so, I mean, just think about every essential divine attribute that you want to predicate of God. Like omnipotence, omniscience, all those omnis, those are intrinsic to God. And so simplicity says that all of those intrinsic attributes are identical to each other and identical to God's existence. And then they'll say the same thing about God's actions. So his act of creating the universe, his act to send Jesus, his act of answering your prayers. Simplicity says that all of those acts are identical to each other such that there is only one divine act. And then that one divine act is identical to God's existence. So God's act of answering your prayer, that's just identical to God's existence somehow. And then like I mentioned in the previous episode, simplicity is like, that's not enough. There's more to the story. So simplicity says that God does not have any properties at all. And that's, again, why I find it so incredibly odd when I see internet classical theists talking about God having so-called Cambridge properties. Because divine simplicity says no properties. And you can't just be like, oh, well, God has no properties, but then try to pretend like God has all of these Cambridge properties. I mean, that's just incoherent. The doctrine of divine simplicity clearly teaches that God does not have any properties. So James Dozel, Catherine Rogers, Jeff Brower, Mike Bergman, Augustine, Peter Lombard, Aquinas, and so many others explicitly say that the simple God does not have any properties, does not have any universals, does not have any forms, does not have any tropes. And then not even accidental properties like creator, lord, or judge of all men. And as John Duns Scotus makes it really clear, he says accidental properties are repugnant to the simple God. So if you want to go around saying that God's got Cambridge properties, like, you know, go for it, that's fine. You just need to understand that that is repugnant to the simple God. Now, that's not all, though. Simplicity says there's more to the story. So simplicity says God does not have any potential whatsoever, instead, like God's pure actuality. And then simplicity says that, you know, because everything that is in God is identical to God, there are no distinctions to be made in God. And so this is why Dozel will say that you can't even have distinct logical moments in the eternal life of God. And so something that we talked about quite a bit in the previous episode is that the doctrine of divine simplicity says that not even conceptual distinctions can be made of God. So Anselm, James Arminius, Catherine Rogers, among many others, make it very explicit that you cannot even make conceptual distinctions in the simple God. And so in the last episode, we chatted about like the role that this denial of conceptual distinctions plays in different classical arguments for divine timelessness. But for this episode, I'm just going to say like, well, you know, divine simplicity says that not even conceptual distinctions apply to God, because that's just where the identity statements take you. So again, simplicity, I think it's a very radical doctrine. I'm constantly amazed by how often people fail to acknowledge this. And then because like someone like even like Kate Rogers, I mean, she's going to say like those identity statements, like divine simplicity, at the very least, that, I mean, it just sounds weird. So I think more people should at least admit at the very least, it just sounds weird.
So, but what if someone says that the identity claims that are not quite accurate? Or it is uncharitable because it sounds absurd to say that God's knowledge is identical to his power, for example.
Mm-hmm. I find this really, really odd because I've had the suggestion made to me a few times over the years. As I see it, there is nothing uncharitable or inaccurate about directly quoting classical theists explicitly saying that God's, like all of God's attributes and actions are identical to each other. Nor is there anything inaccurate or uncharitable in directly quoting classical theists explicitly saying that not even conceptual distinctions apply to God. And so something that we talked about in the last episode is that there's this ancient and medieval principle that classical theists are appealing to when they make these claims. So the principle says that anything that can be divided in the mind can be divided in reality. And so that's like that principle is like, that's what's lurking in the background when you see the denial of conceptual distinctions being applied to God. So basically, if you find yourself uncomfortable with all of the identity claims of divine simplicity, then you just should not be affirming divine simplicity. You could try to hide behind ineffable mystery if you want, but divine simplicity is explicitly committed to these identity claims, and no amount of mystery mongering can avoid that.
So now that we have something of a grasp on divine simplicity, let's talk about your modal collapse objection. What are some different things that people need to know in order to understand the modal collapse objection to classical theism?
So the first thing to know is just like, what is a modal collapse? So modality is the study of concepts like necessity, possibility, and contingency. And so something is necessary if it has to be that way, like it could not fail to be that way. And then something is contingent if it is that way, but it could have been otherwise. So here's some examples. So like 2 + 2 = 4, like that's necessary because it couldn't be any other way. Whereas consider a sentence like Ryan talks to Jonathan, like that's contingent because I didn't have to talk to you today. And a modal collapse is when all of those categories get reduced to just one category. So for example, everything is necessary, nothing is contingent. And like hardly anyone wants that, because if you say that everything is necessary, I mean, like then things really could not have been otherwise. And it just seems like things could have been otherwise. It really does seem like I could have just not talked to you today. And people listening to this episode, they really could have done something else. They could have just listened to some black metal instead. And so the way that the world really is, like, it just seems like it could have been different, right? So most people, they would just want to avoid a modal collapse and say that there's necessity and contingency in the world. And so that's the first thing to know. The second thing to know is that there are lots of different modal collapse objections to different models of God. So modal collapse does not only plague classical theism. When it comes to classical theism, though, there are different versions of the modal collapse objection. And so in my own writing, I mean, I've developed several different versions of the modal collapse argument. So one is like an argument based on an inconsistency between divine freedom and the claim that God is pure actuality. And so that's one that like Stephen Nemesh and I did an episode on like previously on my show. But there's another argument that that I've developed that focuses on the claim that God's actions are identical to God's existence. And so this is a particular argument that I think has been misrepresented in different discussions online and in a recent publication. So people listening, they're probably familiar with a particular like three-premised modal collapse argument that's said to be invalid. But I think there's several things wrong with this three-premised argument that's been like floating around. So first, the argument never defines the doctrine of divine simplicity, and thus it fails to engage with the actual metaphysics, the actual metaphysical claims of divine simplicity. Second, this three-premised argument doesn't actually reflect the argument that I or others have actually presented. So this published paper, what it does is it presents a quote from myself and then a quote from Brian Leftow, and then it presents a three-premised argument that doesn't contain any of the key premises from myself or from Brian Leftow. And I think that's like a really big problem. And then further, this three-premised argument, like it relies on ambiguous premises that are not obviously endorsed by classical theists, whereas like the actual modal collapse arguments that I'm aware of, they rely on clear premises that are in fact explicitly endorsed by classical theists. And then third and finally, like the three-premised argument that's been floating around, what it does is it shifts the conversation to a theory of semantic reference, whereas the actual modal collapse arguments focus on the metaphysical claims of divine simplicity. So what I do in the T.N.T. Clark Handbook of Analytic Theology is I present a version of the modal collapse argument that closely reflects what the actual versions of the argument say. And then I try to, you know, just briefly consider some different replies to the actual modal collapse argument.
So we are going to discuss a modal collapse argument that relies on premises that are explicitly endorsed by classical theists. Those premises are things about the classical theist understanding of divine freedom, creatio ex nihilo, omnipotence, and the source of contingency. So tell us a little bit about this.
So according to classical theism, God is free in that God is the source of his action, and God has the ability to do otherwise. And so when it comes to the doctrine of creation ex nihilo, what classical Christian theists claim is that God is free to create this universe, or free to create a different universe, or he's just free to just say, I don't want to create anything at all. And so the next, I need to say something about how the classical theists understand God's omnipotence. So classical theism is committed to the infallibility of God's omnipotence. So if God intentionally acts or wills to bring about X, whatever X is, then it is not possible for X to fail to obtain. And so as classical theists understand things, if God intentionally acts to bring about this universe with this particular timeline, then it's not possible for this universe and timeline to fail to obtain. So if God intentionally acts to bring about a different universe, then it's not possible for that other universe to fail to obtain. So basically, whatever God intentionally decrees must come about. If God decrees otherwise, then things are going to be otherwise. And so here's a way you could like put it formally. You could say, necessarily, God's willing that X exist or obtain entails that X exist or obtain. And the infallibility of omnipotence, it is built into how the classical Christian theist understands the doctrines of like creation, predestination, election, providence, salvation, incarnation, basically the whole thing. So according to classical theists like John Webster and then the medieval scholar Thomas Ward, the classical tradition is deeply committed to God's actions being intentional precisely because God is a personal and rational being. And so the medieval scholar Thomas Ward, what he says is that the intentionality of God's actions is what guides classical doctrines like creation ex nihilo. So the explanation for why this universe with this particular history comes about is because God intends for this universe and timeline to come about. If God had willed or decreed otherwise, then a different universe and timeline would come about. And so that is a difference-making principle built right into the heart of the classical Christian understanding of God and divine action. And that's just divine creation providence 101 in classical Christian theology. And so here is where God's freedom and omnipotence come together for the classical theist. So God's freedom is crucial for the classical understanding of the universe's contingency. Like God's freedom is the source of contingency. So if God cannot do otherwise, then there are no other possible worlds. So if God has to create this particular universe, then this particular universe is the only possible way things could be given the infallibility of omnipotence. And so that's a modal collapse because there's no contingency. Like everything's going to be absolutely necessary. And because of God's the infallibility of God's omnipotence, God has to be able to choose between alternative possibilities. And so the classical tradition has been very clear in affirming that God does have options when it comes to creation, predestination, and providence.
So classical theists have long been aware of a particular problem. And the problem is this: if God wills or intends to bring about X, then X cannot fail to obtain. And the worry here is that whatever God intends or wills is going to be absolutely necessary, in which case there is no contingency in the world. That is a version of the modal collapse objection that thinkers like Bonaventure, Thomas Aquinas, John Duns Scotus were aware of. How have different classical thinkers expressed their commitment to God's freedom, omnipotence, and contingency of the world in order to avoid this particular problem of modal collapse?
Yeah, so you're right. This is a long-standing problem in the Christian tradition, and that's worth like pointing out. Like it's something to appreciate that they recognize this is a problem. And so many major Christian thinkers, they've tried to figure out how to avoid the implication that the created universe and like all of history is absolutely necessary. And so here's one like popular solution. So there's a difference between absolute necessity and what's called hypothetical or conditional necessity. Absolute necessity, that's when something cannot possibly fail to obtain. So like a great example is would be God's existence, because God's existence is absolutely necessary. Like God cannot possibly fail to exist. And things are different with like a hypothetical or a conditional necessity. So hypothetical necessity says that a certain state of affairs is necessary given some prior conditions. So here'd be an example. Say that you have two apples, and then I give you two more apples. So given those prior conditions, it just necessarily follows that you have four apples. And so as long as those prior conditions are absolutely necessary, this consequence is not going to be absolutely necessary. And this is because I didn't have to give you those two apples. Like I could have done something else. I could have eaten them. I could have thrown them somewhere. You know, like I could have done anything else. And so here's what the classical theist does with all of that. So given God's omnipotence, if God intentionally acts to bring about this particular universe and timeline, then it necessarily follows that this particular universe and timeline will exist. But the classical theist says that this is only a hypothetical or only a conditional necessity because God has free will. So the prior conditions are contingent because God has free will. God does not have to intentionally act to bring about this particular universe and timeline. God could have willed otherwise. So since God could will or act differently, the prior conditions are not absolutely necessary. So the fact that the universe exists is what they'll say is it's only a hypothetical necessity. It's not an absolute necessity. And so the classical theists, what they're saying is that if God's will or act to create the universe is absolutely necessary, then the universe is going to exist of absolute necessity. And that's bad. That's a modal collapse. Like, you know, the classical theist is like, I don't want that. So what she says instead is that there's no problem here because God's act to create this universe is not absolutely necessary. And thus the universe exists of only hypothetical or conditional necessity.
So as you've just explained, that is how different historical classical theists have dealt with problems related to modal collapse. But you think that there's another problem for the classical theist that brings us back to a modal collapse. So tell us a little bit about this problem.
Right. So the modal collapse argument that I've developed says that once you introduce divine simplicity into the mix, you get a conflict between God's freedom and omnipotence. So to avoid the modal collapse, the classical theist needs to maintain that God's act to create this universe, like this particular universe, like that it's contingent. She needs to deny that God's act of creation is absolutely necessary. But what I do is I say that once we reflect on divine simplicity, God's act to create this particular universe is absolutely necessary. And here's how you do it. So I start with four premises that the classical theist explicitly endorses. And I point this out in the chapter and then also in a forthcoming paper. I give a lot of different sources to say this is explicitly endorsed by all these different classical theists. So here are the four premises. So premise one, God's existence is absolutely necessary. Premise two, anything that is identical to God's existence must be absolutely necessary. Premise three, all of God's intentional actions are identical to each other such that there's only one divine act. And then premise four, God's one divine act is identical to God's existence. And so far, like the classical theists, they've, you know, explicitly endorsed all these claims. So there's nothing suspect about the argument at this stage. In the next stage of the argument, I ask everybody just, you know, let's consider what follows from all of this. Like, you know, these widely endorsed classical theistic claims, what follows from that? Well, here's what follows. So premise five, therefore, God's one divine act is absolutely necessary. Premise six, God's intentional act to create the universe is identical to God's one divine act. Premise seven, if God's one divine act is absolutely necessary, then God's intentional act to create the universe is absolutely necessary. Premise eight, therefore, God's intentional act to create the universe is absolutely necessary. Premise nine, therefore, the universe exists of absolute necessity. And so now we have a modal collapse again. And the classical theist wanted to say that God's act to create the universe was not absolutely necessary, but once you introduce divine simplicity, you cannot say that anymore. Excuse me, could you tell me what time it is? Oh, that's right. It's objection time. This is how we do it. This is how we do it. Sorry, that's the wrong music. Objection
time! So, objection time. Mm-hmm. At this point in the conversation, I want us to consider some different kinds of objections and responses to this particular modal collapse argument and why you think they are problematic. One response is to say that the argument form is invalid. And what do you make of that?
I find it really difficult to understand how the argument could possibly be invalid, like once you consider the actual metaphysical claims of divine simplicity. Like, I mean, there's nothing invalid about saying that, you know, if two things are identical, then they share the same modal status. That's just identity. And there's also nothing invalid about drawing out the entailments of basic identity claims. And so whenever I've encountered like the suggestion of invalidity, I've noticed that what it does is this. It rearticulates the modal collapse argument with ambiguous premises. It ignores the actual metaphysical claims of divine simplicity. And then it shifts the conversation to a semantic theory of reference. So basically, whenever I've seen a suggestion of invalidity, I've seen a completely different argument presented to the one that I have actually offered. And in fact, I think it's a completely different argument than the ones offered by people like Brian Leftow or William Lane Craig. And in which case, this isn't really a response to my argument or their arguments. It's just changing the conversation. And I'm not the first person to say this. Like, this is not a unique claim to me. So Bill Valicella, he's a classical theist and he defends divine simplicity. For some people, you might know who Valicella is because he's the one who wrote the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry on divine simplicity. So Valicella, who once again, he defends divine simplicity, he's pointed out several times that there is nothing invalid in the modal collapse argument. So Valicella says that classical theists like himself, what they have to do is they have to embrace the modal collapse argument. And Jonathan, I think you watched the YouTube dialogue that I did with Kate Rogers on the Majesty of Reason.
Yep.
Yeah. So she was really clear in that video that, yeah, divine simplicity entails there's only one possible world. And she didn't want to call it modal collapse because, you know, that just sounds bad. But what she did in that video and then in her recent publications, what she does is she calls it modal simplicity because it sounds nicer. And so, but she's really clear, though, that the end result is the same. And then further, like Johnny Waldrop, he has a forthcoming paper that demonstrates that this allegedly invalid argument, it's actually valid when you introduce standard theistic claims about creation and divine power. And then Omar Fakhri has recently published a paper that shows just how easy it is to produce a valid form of the argument. So basically, if you pay attention to the actual metaphysical claims of divine simplicity, there's no modal invalidity.
So there's another response to the modal collapse argument that relies on this semantic theory of reference that you were referring to. It says that the statement God's act of creation doesn't refer to God in all possible worlds. The technical jargon is that the term God's act of creation does not rigidly designate God. Thus, you cannot validly infer that God's act of creation is necessary. So what do you make of that?
So yeah, it is this like kind of technical jargon going on here, but I don't think that's terribly important. I think this response is it's pretty easy to dispense with because it entails denying the doctrine of divine simplicity. And that's not a great place to be in if your goal is to defend divine simplicity. So let me briefly explain like what the claim is being made here. So here's the idea. So if a statement like rigidly designates or rigidly refers or co-refers to a particular object, you have made an identity claim. And if the reference is not rigid or if it doesn't co-refer or whatever, then you have not made an identity claim. And so what this response says, when it says that God's act of creation, when it says that it does not rigidly designate God, what this means is that God's act of creation is not identical to God. And given that they are not identical, well, then, I mean, then of course you can say that God's act of creation is not absolutely necessary. But here's the problem with this response. Divine simplicity explicitly says that God and his intentional act of creation are identical. So the reference has to be rigid in order to preserve the actual identity claims of divine simplicity. So if you deny that the reference is rigid, you are denying that they are identical, which means that you are denying the explicit teachings of divine simplicity. And so classical theists like Bonaventure and Kate Rogers, they say that we do refer to God by his acts, since those acts are identical to each other and identical to God. And in fact, Brian Leftow, like he's already answered this reply in 2006. And so Leftow, like he says, the actual divine volition and God, he says, those are co-referential given the doctrine of divine simplicity. So again, this reply to the modal collapse argument, as far as I can tell, it's just denying the doctrine of divine simplicity. And it's certainly true that you can avoid the modal collapse by denying divine simplicity, but the goal of this response was to defend divine simplicity. So this response is just a non-starter.
Thank you for that. So another response says that God's acts are the same in all possible worlds, though the created universe does not exist in all possible worlds. The only thing that makes God's act an act of creation is whether or not the universe exists. So whether or not God's act is an act of creation is an extrinsic contingent matter.
Yeah. So let me start with what others have said, and then I'll give my like own hot take on it. So like Brian Leftow and Kate Rogers, they say that this like so-called extrinsic divine action, it just gets the order of explanation backwards. So the extrinsic account says that the universe exists, so therefore God's act is an act of creation. And Leftow and Rogers say that that's just incoherent and backwards because God's act of creation is what makes the universe exist. And so Leftow goes on to say that this extrinsic account is basically solving problems by, quote, pure magic. So he doesn't really think very highly of this move. And then Rogers, like, she thinks even less of it. So she points out that extrinsic accounts entail that God's love literally plays no explanatory role in why the universe exists. And as she sees it, this just flies in the face of central Christian teachings about divine love. So she thinks that the extrinsic account of divine action is just a non-starter for Christians. So that's a, you know, very prominent classical theist just saying, you can't possibly say this and be a Christian. Here's my own hot take, though. So I think that this extrinsic account of divine action, I just think it's a wildly inaccurate statement about what the classical theist's own claims about divine action. So I think it ignores three things. So first, it ignores the classical theist's commitment to the infallibility of omnipotence, which, like you may recall, is the claim that when God performs an intentional act to bring something about, that thing cannot fail to be brought about. And then second, this response ignores the classical theist's commitment to God's perfect rationality, which says that God always acts for a reason. The extrinsic account of action explicitly denies that God's acts involve intentions. And so you've just, you know, you've given up classical theism. That's bad. Third, this extrinsic response ignores the scholastic understanding of action. So on the scholastic understandings of action, an act is intrinsic to an agent, and an act is denominated by the agent's intended goal. And so this is the scholastic understanding of action, and classical theists apply it to God when developing Christian theology. So different Catholic and Protestant scholastic theologians, they have all sorts of ways of capturing this within their doctrines of creation and predestination. So they have these distinctions like between God's like antecedent and consequent will, or they'll talk about like God's ideal will and God's intended or decreed will. But like, here's the big idea. The classical theist says that God's acts are denominated by God's intended goal, like the divine goal of creating this particular universe. So if God intended to create a different universe, then that's like a different act because that has a different intended goal. And so when you keep that in mind, let's go back to like considering that extrinsic reply again. So the extrinsic response said that what makes God's act an act of creation is whether or not the universe exists. But that just doesn't make any sense given the scholastic understanding of an action. Like, actions are denominated by the agent's goals. So in classical Christian theism, God's decree is his set of goals for creation and the economy of salvation. So what actually makes God's act an act of creation is God's own goal. So given the scholastic understanding of action, what makes God's act an act of creation is whether or not God intends to bring about the existence of a universe. And this classical commitment is reflected in the premises of my modal collapse argument. And so here is what you get when you keep in mind the scholastic understanding of action, God's perfect rationality, and the infallibility of omnipotence. If we say that God's act of intending to create this particular universe is identical to God's existence, we are saying that God's act of intending to create this particular universe is the same across all possible worlds. And so given the classical theist's commitment to the infallibility of omnipotence, it just follows that this particular universe exists in all possible worlds. Well, that doesn't help you avoid the modal collapse. What it does is it just reintroduces the modal collapse. And in fact, this is one reason why Valicella says, look, classical theists, what we need to do, we just need to embrace the modal collapse.
So what if the classical theist says, well, this account of divine action is too anthropomorphic. Maybe God doesn't really have intentional actions and does not act for reasons. Maybe God does not actually intend anything. And the whole idea of God acting for a reason is just making God too human. It's making God too much like us. So would that help with this particular response to the modal collapse objection?
I just want to say no. Like, it's not going to help if you're trying to defend what actual classical Christian theism affirms. I mean, the idea that God has intentions and goals, like, that's just built into classical theism's commitment to God's perfect rationality. I mean, the classical teaching is that God always acts for a reason. I mean, God's perfect rationality, it generated a lot of different puzzles related to creation and providence, but classical theists, like, they do everything they can to maintain God's perfect rationality in light of those puzzles. And so people like John Webster, who's a classical theist, and then medieval scholars like Alfred Fredoso and Thomas Ward, what they point out is that intentional divine acts and goals are built into the classical articulations of Christian doctrines like creation, predestination, providence, salvation, and so on. So it's just baked right into it. And the classical theist Ron Highfield, in his book on creation and providence, this is a direct quote from Ron Highfield. He says, quote, God's act of creating is not irrational or arbitrary, but is accompanied by God's intentions and is directed towards an end. So that's a quote from an actual classical theist saying he's got intentions. Now, here's another classical theist that some people might be familiar with, Thomas Aquinas. So in Summa Contra Gentiles 2:24, Aquinas condemns the notion that God creates the universe for no reason. He says, like, you just can't do that. If you deny that God performs intentional actions, then you are rejecting the way that classical Christian theists have actually articulated basic Christian doctrine. And that's not the best place to be in if you're trying to defend classical Christian doctrine. So let me give some like concrete examples of this. So in the classical Christian tradition, like, there's like some standard questions in academic theology about like the incarnation and the atonement. And so here is like one standard assumption prior to the modern era. So they'll say God could have brought about salvation in multiple ways. And so my friend Ali in at the University of Helsinki, he said, you know, like, one way to think about it is like, you know, God could just say, here's a cat, just punch the cat a bunch of times. And there you go. You could get some salvation. You know, that's one option. Well, so what things like that do, though, is like they bring up a particular question. So here's one question. So why have an incarnation in order to achieve salvation of mankind? Because, like, you know, why an incarnation instead of just God saying, just punch this cat? You know, this is the way the Finnish would put it. Well, so here's another standard assumption in the classical tradition, though, is this, is that the Father or the Holy Spirit could have become incarnate instead of the Son. And so that gives rise to a different question, which is, why did the Son become incarnate instead of the Holy Spirit or the Father? And so thinkers like Peter Lombard, Anselm, Aquinas, they try to develop different kinds of answers to these questions. And so what they do is they all look for reasons that God might have for becoming incarnate and reasons for why God the Son should become incarnate instead of the Father or the Holy Spirit. And Anselm and Aquinas argue that certain divine actions are just more fitting or more rationally appropriate in order to achieve God's intended purposes. And so they try to argue that God's reasons for the incarnation are the best way to achieve human salvation, and that God's reasons for sending the Son instead of the Holy Spirit, that just it just makes more sense. And so everything I said, I mean, that's just standard classical Christian theology. I mean, these sorts of claims, they're just all over the writings of the Catholic and Protestant scholastics. But notice something, though, about this discussion of the incarnation and the atonement. This entire discussion has built into it the assumption that God performs intentional actions for a reason. These intentional actions have a goal. And if God intended to bring something else about, well, God could have, but for some reason, God didn't. So given what I've just said, I mean, think back again about that reply to the modal collapse objection here. I mean, the reply said that the classical theist could just deny that God performs intentional actions or just deny that God acts for reasons. Well, I just say that classical theists cannot just deny that God performs intentional actions. She cannot do this precisely because God's intentional actions are affirmed by classical theists in major Christian doctrines, including within the doctrine of God. So if you give up God's intentional actions, you have to deny the way that classical theists have actually articulated Christian doctrine and God's perfect rationality. And you can do that if you want, but I don't think it's a good idea to defend classical Christian theism by just denying vast portions of classical Christian theology. That's just not a good idea. Well, Jonathan, though, thank you so much for coming on the show again today to talk about these things with me. Like, this is really helpful.
Absolutely, man. I appreciate it.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for episodes on risk management, the phenomenology of Scripture, and so much more.